KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have a return guest on the show, a professor whose work I am a huge fan of and whose work is getting increasingly the recognition that it rightly deserves, Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, author of the forthcoming article in the University of Chicago Law Review entitled Orwell's Armchair. And what is this about? As the title suggests, we're referring, of course, to George Orwell. Particularly, Derek is referring to his most famous work, 1984. And so what's this armchair deal? Well, we're going to talk about that, but the focus here is censorship, a topic of increasing, in my view, unfortunately, increasing importance, not just in countries and locations that are more typically known for censorship, but here in the United States. And in Derek's article, he builds on some previous work to offer a suggestion which certainly it was counterintuitive to me initially when he proposed in the beginning of the article, but over the course of the article made more sense. Derek's point, and he'll explain this in more detail as we go through the interview, is that censorship is happening, and it's happening in the United States. Despite our whatever ideals we have about it, despite what we think our policies are designed to achieve, the government is censoring speech in a variety of ways. And rather than write an article challenging the government's right or ability to censor, Derek offers a proposal which I think is very interesting but quite counterintuitive. Let's formalize censorship. And what that means is let's have a process in place that allows the public to understand clearly what is censorable, what is not, how that process works, and what ultimately it will do to your experience surfing the internet or more broadly, dealing with technology. And so the goal here in the article is to establish that that ultimately is a policy worth considering. And through the article, Derek analyzes, and the best way to think about it is really through directly the table of contents, he looks at ultimately how governments censor, what the challenges are from a legitimacy standpoint involving censorship, what limits there might be on the ability of the government to censor, and then ultimately proposes a way to establish this regime. So this challenge, therefore, is one that is referred to in the title as Orwell's armchair. That is the concern that the government is quietly and slowly, as Derek puts it, easing people into a comfort level with censorship that we should ultimately be concerned about. And so the article takes this wide-ranging view leading to a counterintuitive proposal, but an interesting one. And over the course of our discussion today, we're going to pick apart some of those issues and discuss what their implications might be. So I'm very excited, again, to have Derek on. He was on, I want to say now, maybe a couple of years ago, with Oliver Day, discussing a previous article that he co-authored with Oliver entitled Hacker's Aegis, which I greatly enjoyed. Subsequently, and I will say, I've said this before on the blog, but I'll say it publicly, Oliver subsequently had a very unique role with Hearsay Culture where he volunteered his time to solve the problem that I had mentioned on the show a few times and that some of you who search for Hearsay Culture might have noticed, which was that Hearsay Culture for a while had been hacked by spammers who were turning Hearsay Culture, at least from a Google perspective, into a Viagra and Cialis link farm. That was solved by Oliver in a way that I probably shouldn't say publicly, but Oliver volunteered his time to solve it, and for that I am greatly appreciative. I have not yet returned the favor in the sense of paying back Oliver, but I do offer him at this point and continue to offer the public thanks and respect and gratitude that any volunteer who solves these problems deserves. Having said that, we are joined today only by his co-author, but very excited to have that co-author here, Derek Bambauer, who is joining us from his home in Brooklyn, and I should say, will be moving to the University of Arizona School of Law in the fall. Congratulations on that move, Derek, and thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture.
Dave, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here, even though I can offer far fewer hacking skills than Oliver, who's truly a ninja at this stuff.
Well, I was very impressed, and hopefully I won't need any of that advice on a going forward basis, but I appreciate that. Derek, let's start off with a question that I'm a little more specific than the question I started with the last time I interviewed you. If you would talk in a little more detail about the genesis of your interest in censorship as a topic to focus upon.
I started off thinking about censorship really in law school. I was following Jonathan Zittrain's work where he was studying censorship by other countries. And there are really sort of three epochs or periods of censorship internet-wise. The first is that censorship seems like it's impossible. So John Gilmore says that the internet treats censorship as damage and routes around it. And then it turns out that this is unfortunately false. And so we get version two, which is when I started looking at this. And in version two of internet censorship, it's just the bad countries who do it. It's authoritarian regimes like Saudi Arabia and Iran and China. And so you can very reliably use the presence of internet censorship as a proxy for a country's governance and attitude towards free speech and whatnot. And things started to get interesting in sort of the mid-2000s when we entered, where we're now firmly, version 3, which is that censorship is essentially ubiquitous. So when it's France, Germany, South Korea, Australia, England, increasingly the United States, engaged in censorship, it's a much more complex and interesting world. And I started work on this as a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, and spent 2 years doing this. And I went to Vietnam and tested censorship in person. And at that point, I really thought that the work that Berkman was doing was important, but that it would be almost sort of like international law. We would be studying places far away from the U.S. And it was really only with the coming to power of the Obama administration that all of a sudden we entered the salad days for those of us who were interested in internet censorship, because the Obama administration really expanded the things that it was trying to lock down or to control on the internet. And so all of a sudden I realized that, in fact, this was sort of the proof of version 3 of internet censorship, that finally censorship had come to really the sort of last bastion of free speech exceptionalism, which is America.
So that leads to one of the real challenges, I think, that we have here. And let me start it off at a top level, because I alluded to it, but I think it's a good way to begin our discussion. I define what you mean by Orwell's armchair, but I think it gets to why this is a particular concern right now. So can you tell us what you mean by the title, Orwell's armchair? To what are you referring?
With Orwell's armchair, I was thinking about the fact that the U.S. has indubitably decided to censor the internet. So we seize domain names. We take down sites like Mega Upload with the help of New Zealand's authorities. And so the suggestion that, in fact, America is still sort of a bulwark against internet censorship is just plainly incorrect. And there were efforts early on in the sort of popularization, commercialization of the internet to formalize censorship, primarily focused around indecent content, pornography and the like, through law. And you've studied those, and so this is the Communications Decency Act mm-hmm. and the Children's Online Protection Act. And those are struck down by the Supreme Court, and it looks like legislation simply isn't going to work. But the censorial impulse is sufficiently strong that the government, both federal and state governments, particularly the federal government, have worked around that limit. And they've done so in a way that involves a set of more indirect and more subtle techniques that I actually think are more pernicious, because they are less amenable to oversight and to challenge than legislation is. And so my worry is that by doing this, by using indirect techniques, whether it's seizing domain names or encouraging intermediaries to delist or to censor or not process payments for WikiLeaks, we will be gradually entering a world where censorship is nearly invisible and is increasingly comfortable, and we simply come to accept it. And so the contrast is between something like the domain name seizures and the public uproar that took place over the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act, which really demonstrate that there's still a sort of visceral response to overt censorship. but there's much less concern or controversy over these what I call soft methods of censorship. And so my worry is that we will be gradually eased onto a set of filtered platforms and filtered pipes without really noticing it.
When you talk about that gradual easing, I think it's useful, particularly for people that perhaps aren't even as familiar with the mega upload seizure, which we could talk about in a moment, to contrast where we are with censorship today versus where we were prior to the internet. Because I think when I think of censorship initially, my initial thought is, my side interest in books involving intelligence gathering and the intelligence community. And so whenever you see a biography or even a book written about CIA activities, for example, you will see a legend at the beginning of the book that says this book has been reviewed by an office at the CIA, and there are certain parts that are blacked out. And then as you go through the book, you literally see blacked out passages of the text. That's my vision of censorship. But I think you're talking about censorship in a slightly different way, or perhaps a broader way. So perhaps you could define censorship as you see it today. What is the focus of censorship in this article?
The way that I define censorship is, I think, a little bit unusual, and so I'm glad you asked me to spell this out in a little more detail, which is I think that censorship's a method. I think it's basically prior restraint, and the example you give is a very good one. So if the government decides that it doesn't like something, and it blacks out sentences in a book, or as with China, it glues pages of National Geographic magazine with a disputed map of Tibet in it together so you can't read them, that's censorship. The reason that this is a little bit different than the way that Americans usually think about it is that we tend to think of censorship equals bad. And that is something that I think is important to actually split into two steps. The first thing that we ought to do is we ought to recognize the mechanism. And on the internet, censorship is really about keeping a willing user, a willing listener, from reaching information that a willing speaker or author wants to share, essentially interdicting it using technological methods. So that step is a sort of descriptive one. It's to say, what is the government doing? And the second step is to try to figure out whether or not that's legitimate, whether or not we want to think that this is normatively acceptable. In sort of standard parlance, we conflate the two. So this is the debate that you hear a lot around things like intellectual property rights or copyright infringement. People say, no, this isn't censorship because it's okay to enforce intellectual property rights. And the move that I want to make is to say it's absolutely censorship. It may be justifiable censorship, but we should not fool ourselves about the mechanisms that we're using. And that's because it's a little bit difficult to see that, for example, when China uses the same mechanism of restricting access to content that the Stop Online Piracy Act proposes to use, it's hard intellectually to claim that one is censorship and one isn't. It's easier to say that they're both censorship, but it's just that we think that one is necessary and China's is not.
Mm-hmm. And I think that granular thinking about censorship is one that we see increasingly happening in a variety of areas that involve speech, right? So from the secrecy perspective, we see people thinking those terms. There has been a growth in recent literature involving transparency to say, well, we need to think more granularly about that. Even privacy, which I think has a richer tradition in that direction, at least from my perspective, than those other focuses do, talks in those terms. There are certain times where we ultimately want to preserve privacy rights, and there are other times where we think about privacy as merely one option that a consumer, for example, has in a given transaction. But when we're talking about censorship, I think it's important, and you make this point, and I want to drill down on it as well before we go further into how we define it and your use of hard versus soft censorship, to think about how individuals today expect to receive information. And so the idea of censorship, again, in the past was an idea that there was perhaps a good reason, okay? I say the past, so let's say prior to Watergate, right? There was some reason that we could ultimately have faith in that our government, though focusing on the U.S., was keeping information from us because there was a basis behind it. Freedom of information laws, with their exemptions, in fact, spell out when we're going to have censorship of a sort. But I think the internet, right? And you, and to think about this more broadly, the internet doesn't give us that same explanation, right? It doesn't give us the same information to explain the decisions that are made. And you talk about transparency up front, and you continue that theme throughout the article. Perhaps we could drill down here initially on that. What ultimately, as a consumer of information through the internet, does an individual actually know about censorship regimes today?
It's really difficult, and it depends in part on who's doing the censorship and why. So, for example, if you use Apple's iPhone, there are certain apps that you can't get. They're ones that either involve pornography, or they involve controversial political topics, or in some cases they just involve political cartoons, oddly enough. So Apple is, you know, sort of censorious in some ways. And the difficulty there is that unless it makes sort of the press, unless the media pays attention to it, it's invisible. You don't know what's missing from the iPhone app store. With government seizures, again, it varies. One thing that we should give credit to the Obama administration for is that when they've done things such as seized domain names, and they seized a little over 300 in advance of the Super Bowl, apparently counterfeit NFL jerseys are now a sort of significant public issue such that we need to devote enforcement resources to them.
Right.
They actually put up a warning, right, a little logo, so that when you try to get to the site, if it's something that streams NFL games or sells fake Michael Vick jerseys or whatnot, it says, this site has been seized, and it gives you a reference to the statutory provisions under which it's been seized. And so you know that your internet experience has been altered artificially. It's also possible, and other countries such as Vietnam do this, where you try to reach the site and it's just as though there's no there. You get back a technical error and you think, my goodness, this site has gone off the air. But it hasn't. It's just that your request has been intercepted. And so one of the difficulties is that we just know less because of the technology of the internet about when our experience is being altered. And this is something that I really worry about. We don't have the fallback of seeing that the lines in the book are blacked out or that the pages of National Geographic are glued together, mm-hmm. that censorship can appear a lot like just ordinary technical errors. And so this has profound implications for things that you've been working on, such as transparency and accountability. And it's something that that I'm worried about, that in some senses, overt censorship regimes at least let us know that the government is bowdlerizing material, whereas soft or sort of less visible censorship regimes may make us think this is just how it is.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking with Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School on Hearsay Culture and KZSU-FM. Derek, let's talk about those distinctions. You have primarily five types, if you will, of censorship, which you define as hard versus soft. Can you give the examples of hard censorship versus soft censorship from a top-level perspective, and we'll drill down on some of them shortly?
Absolutely. So just to let your listeners know what I'm doing, what I'm thinking about is that the government has a variety of tools in its toolkit to censor the internet, and that they really range along a continuum of how directly the state is involved. So the most direct way to do it is simply just have control over the networks. So one example of this is publicly provided wireless internet access. Let me give you two examples. One, which I mentioned in the paper, is Chesterfield County in Virginia, where it offers free Wi-Fi access to citizens, but you can't get the naughty bits on it, right? So there's no porn available over the network. A more controversial example is that during the labor protests in Wisconsin over the governor's efforts to essentially reduce the influence of labor unions, if you accessed the free public wireless in the state capitol building, you couldn't actually get to one of the labor union's websites. It was blocked by the wireless network. And so that's the most direct form of control, which is you literally impose it at the architectural level of the network. It just throws away your requests. The second most direct way to do it is not to actually have physical control over the network, which is still pretty rare in the United States. It's internet access and internet transport is primarily provided by private entities, is to actually put in place laws that require those private entities to censor on your behalf. And so examples of this, as we mentioned earlier, things like the Communications Decency Act, COPPA, the Children's Online Protection Act, And there have been some efforts at the state level to do this. So one that I was involved in a little bit is that the state of Minnesota tried through its gambling regulations to force ISPs, Verizon and Comcast and others, to block access to internet gambling sites on the grounds that it violated Minnesota's state anti-gaming laws. And so this is a way of essentially using the power of law to put the arm on powerful intermediaries such as internet service providers or search engines to block on one's behalf. And so there, in both of those examples, which is a sort of direct control over the network and also legal mandates to intermediaries, the state's role is plainly visible and quite direct. The state is essentially admitting, look, we are censoring here. For soft censorship, I have really three sets of techniques. The first is pretext, which is that the state uses laws that aren't related to information or internet or censorship even as a way of controlling content. And so this, I think, is what is happening with the Obama administration's seizure of domain names. They're using a generic civil forfeiture statute to go out and seize domain names that they think are related to criminal copyright infringement. The statute, it was never really contemplated to be used against domain names. It's not even plain that they thought it would be used for, against speech at all. But the Obama administration has used it as a sort of convenient cat's paw to do something that arguably can't do through direct regulation. So that's pretext. The second is that the government can simply pay people to censor. They can pay you to self-censor, or more powerfully, they can pay intermediaries to censor. And we're familiar with the fact that the federal government ties funding for schools and libraries to a mandate that they filter out obscenity and child pornography and material that is, quote, harmful to minors. And they've begun to do this much more, I think, interestingly, through the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, which says if you want your school to be eligible for federal student loans and federal student grants, you have to put in place mechanisms that prevent unauthorized peer-to-peer file sharing and copyright infringement. And so given how dependent institutions of higher education are on this type of federal funding, it's an enormously powerful lever. And then the last one is that the government can try to either persuade or pressure entities into censorship. So one thing we see there, right, probably most famously, is the government pressure on MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal, and Amazon to stop doing business with WikiLeaks. And it turns out that this is probably even more effective than direct censorship would be. Julian Assange has said that after this happened, after the State Department and the Obama administration put pressure on these entities, their funding, their revenues dropped by 95% because they can no longer take credit card or PayPal donations. So that's a role where the state formally isn't doing anything other than expressing its disapprobation for WikiLeaks, and yet nonetheless has a profound effect on the site's ability to share information.
You know, these this listing of different techniques, I think, leads to an interesting follow-up, which is in your research, given that you focus in these areas, was there any example of censorship, either hard or soft, that surprised even you? In other words, were when you were doing the research, even with your understanding of these regimes, you came across an example you thought, I didn't know this was happening, I didn't realize it was happening, or literally something where you said, I need to rethink how I think about censorship. Does anything come to mind? Because you go through a variety of scenarios in the article.
I think the most surprising to me, oddly enough, were the domain name seizures. And it was in part because I just didn't think that the government had the power to do this. And so when they started doing it, and it really looked to me like a sort of classic prior restraint on speech. You mentioned national security concerns, right, going back to the Pentagon Papers case and so forth. And to me, it had always been sort of almost like holy writ that one simply could not go out and seize information, seize speech, without having fairly significant court oversight, so that prior restraint is utterly exceptional in American law. And you mentioned you have to have a really good reason to do it, right? So the suggestions from the Supreme Court that maybe you could do it if a newspaper was going to publish the dates and times on which troop ships would sail, or there was an injunction against the magazine The Progressive, which was trying to publish how to make a hydrogen bomb. that's a lot more important than somebody who's, you know, offering unauthorized Lady Gaga MP3 files. And so when I started to dig into the statutory provisions that purportedly allow the government to do this, I really first was surprised at sort of how broad they were, and second, I was surprised at how shaky the government's position was. So the government, the Obama administration, has set up a censorship regime seizing domain names really on, I think, fairly thin grounds. And what's so strange about it to me is that there is currently only one site, a site called Roja Directa. It's a Spanish site that offers links to English Premier League matches and the like, that's actually challenging the seizures. They're being represented by your Stanford colleague, Mark Lemley, and his law firm. And the odd thing about this is that so far, the judge, who's here in the Southern District of New York, has just given utterly short shrift to the free speech arguments. And he's essentially said, this is copyright infringement, has nothing to do with speech and nothing to do with censorship. And I was shocked that a federal judge who's sort of steeped in our tradition of resistance to prior restraint and concern for free expression would be so cavalier in his analysis. But so far, that's what's holding up. And so it's really odd to me that we have this enormously powerful cultural norm of resistance to censorship, right? So we see Google and Wikipedia and other sites blacking out as a way of protesting SOPA and the Protect IP Act. And yet, in the background, we have this sort of very quiet way of the federal government seizing domain names, blocking access to sites and speech, where really it's just sort of happening sub rosa, and people aren't really that worked up about it.
We're chatting with Professor Derek Bembauer of Brooklyn Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on donate. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen both to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU. Yeah, you know, Derek, going back to domain name seizures for a moment, which I agree, I certainly have been surprised by the ferocity of the steps, and yet you have a website like Mega Upload, where the press, the mainstream press, covered that issue and had a field day with its founder Kim.com, who changed his name, who is shown in almost Will Ferrell comedy type pictures. Right, running around, you know, on jet skis and in mansions, and basically looking like he's partying his whole life away. This kind of image of the kind of entity that is censored isn't controversial, I think, to a lot of people who would say, "Yeah, this guy's stealing, and he's stealing from the United States, and he should be punished." And so that's. Idea of domain name seizure, perhaps now is at least more well known. But the shocking part to me, and I'm curious to get your response to this, is the methods that the government has to actually do this. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about that without getting hyper technical. How does literally the government seize a domain name? What does that process entail?
The strange thing about this is that history matters, even for the internet. We often think of the internet as a sort of ahistorical zone, but it matters a lot that the root of some of the domain names is here in the United States. So, for example, .com is run out of Virginia. VeriSign runs it. And that means that the United States has considerable leverage over any site that appears in the .com domain. And so what they do is that they... the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice typically work jointly on this, and they go to a federal magistrate judge with a warrant that alleges that a certain site is engaged in criminal copyright infringement, which essentially means you're sort of willfully infringing or distributing files that are somebody else's intellectual property. And on if the judge grants their warrant request, then they serve it on VeriSign, and VeriSign simply redirects requests to that domain name off to this warning logo that I described. And that means that, effectively speaking, this site is still accessible in certain ways, but not nearly so easily. And this means that essentially the government, in a rather one-sided proceeding, which is often employs evidence gathered almost exclusively by private rights holders, such as record labels or movie studios, is able, just by dint of the fact that the internet started here in the United States, to exert a good deal of control over a medium that is international. And this has all sorts of really interesting implications for how nation states impose their will in a world where a site may be arbitrarily located in one country, but have users in hundreds of countries. And so, for example, this Spanish site, Roja Directa, that I've been talking about, their practices have been challenged in Spain twice, and Spanish courts have held that they are operating lawfully. And in some sense, the U.S. gets an override of those Spanish court decisions just by dint of the fact that .com happens to be located here in Virginia.
So the location of the servers matters at some level, but also the speech itself, which gets us, I think, to discuss in more detail your proposal. I summarized it, but I want to give you the opportunity to fine-grain that a bit. Describe, if you will, your proposal at the top level, and then we'll get into what the elements of that regime might look like.
At the top level, in some sense, my proposal is just pessimism writ large, which is the instinct, I think, even still here in America, is that we should resist censorship, that we'll fight it on the beaches, and we'll fight it in the hills, and fight it in the streets, and we'll never stop fighting. And I think the fight's over, because I think that the Obama administration is already carrying out censorship. And so what I want to do is I want to cabinet. I want it to be maximally accountable. I want it to be maximally open and transparent, and I want it to be as narrow and limited as possible. And I think that the way that you do this is by enacting a law that allows the government to censor certain sites. And the reason that I want that to happen is that I think that we will get a better result if we have input from everyone, input from internet users and people who run sites like Mega Upload, and artists and record labels and movie studios and ISPs. And right now, the input is solely one-sided. It is just content owners who are driving these decisions. And so I am not sure that we should adopt such a law, but I do think it's better, if we're going to censor, that we do so directly through public law rather than indirectly through a sort of set of moves that involve subterfuge and that only take account of one set of interests in the equation.
Mm-hmm. And let me push back a little on this, because, and you've alluded to it, but just to explore this idea. So let me take up that top level objection, if you will. Right? Why now? In other words, why now do we decide, okay, this is what's happening, it's not going to change, so let's have a regime? You mentioned the Obama administration, but administrations change, mores change, laws change. What makes now the time to seriously consider this proposal?
I think that what's going on is that in some senses we have ended internet exceptionalism. We used to think that the internet just operated differently in terms of the rules about censorship and speech, that it was essentially a sort of free fire zone beyond the grip of territorial states' control. And I don't think that's right anymore. So, as I said, in this new sort of version 3 of internet censorship, it's not just the bad guys who censor anymore. It's most Western democracies. And that's actually not all that exceptional. So America doesn't censor much, but we certainly do censor some things. We censor things on behalf of national security. Copyright law is in some ways a form of censorship. We censor things like child pornography and obscenity. And so, in some sense, this is an inevitable realignment where we simply bring the way that we treat speech on the internet back into the same framework that we do speech offline. And in fairness, this is something that will make some people unhappy. I'm not sure that I'm entirely pleased about it myself. The internet is the sort of greatest mechanism for democratic communication since Gutenberg invented the printing press. But I think that we risk actually having greater impositions on freedom of speech and greater impositions on the power of the internet if we allow the status quo to march forward. And so this may be a time when we can actually set in place not just a way to censor, but a way to prevent censorship, a set of checks and balances, a way that allows sites like Roja Directive that are targeted to actually be able to contest things more quickly and to do so before the government pushes them offline. And so in some sense, it's just historical accident that this is the moment, but I think in some ways this moment was perhaps inevitable.
Would your proposal apply, and I think it would from what I've read, apply to all forms of censorship that you describe in the article?
Absolutely. And my hope in this sense is that what would happen is that this so-called hard censorship, right, a statute that specifically allowed the government to take and not take certain actions, would displace these other forms of censorship. One worry, and a criticism I think is entirely fair, is that perhaps it wouldn't. Maybe it would just give the government more tools.
Right.
So an example there is that if you look, for example, at the government's wiretapping or its request for information, when we started to provide the option of using national security letters under the Patriot Act, it's not that that displaced warrants. It's that it increased alongside warrants. And so I think what we would have to have, right, is that the statute would have to say this is the exclusive way of driving a site offline. And so it would, in some senses, displace these other mechanisms. One possible rebuttal here is to say, you know, the government only can spend so much energy on censoring the internet. Football, you know, sort of knockoff football jerseys are a big social problem, but there's plenty of others out there. And so if you give the government a way to do this that is clean and relatively low cost and clear, they are going to be more likely to use it, in part because it'll be cheaper and more effective than these other more indirect mechanisms.
That idea of giving the government more tools towards censorship, I think, leads to one last point or challenge, perhaps, to the proposal, which is that the government not only doesn't need any more basis to do it, and not only that they'd have more tools, but it might legitimize more broadly the idea of censorship across a variety of areas where, again, we still challenge it. Are you concerned that, to use your phrase of cynicism, although I might just say it's realistic, to be a little bit more charitable than you've been to your proposal, are you concerned that legitimizing censorship in this medium, which has been known for free speech, either correctly or incorrectly, could bleed into other areas where we are more protective, perhaps? Like, for example, let's say, freedom of the press as a broad principle as opposed to applied to the internet. Is there a slippery slope or blurring concern that you have by proposing it here?
I think that Americans' instinctive resistance to censorship is extraordinarily powerful, and the protests over SOPA and Protect IP are the best recent example of this. And I think it does a lot of work for us both domestically, and it's something that is enormously influential internationally. In fact, one needle that the Obama administration has had considerable difficulty threading is, for example, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's advocacy for the internet as a means of democratic expression. So you have places like the New America Foundation that are working on Commotion Wireless, the internet in a suitcase, a way to bypass censorship in places like Egypt or Tunisia or Libya that are undergoing democratic revolutions. And so the Obama administration has had a good deal of difficulty squaring that up with its efforts to take things offline. So I do feel some concern that a proposal like this might weaken that commitment that we all have to free speech. I will say that I am sort of less concerned about that worry for two reasons. The first is that we've already got censorship. It just is disguised as something else. It's disguised as protecting children or disguised as enforcing intellectual property rights or whatnot. And so if all we're doing is fighting about the rubric for it, and in fact censorship is occurring on the ground, then I'm much less worried about sacrificing the term. I would rather focus on what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. The second is that ultimately my faith is in governance, is in the way that we make decisions. And so we have to have a confidence in our governance processes that we will, in fact, be able to balance these competing considerations, whether it's, you know, the rights of IP holders on the one hand and free speech on the other. if the only thing that's preventing the government from imposing widespread censorship is some sort of generalized norm, then our democracy is considerably more damaged than I think it is. And I have some hope that we've actually been able to do this effectively in the past. So a lot of people hate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but it's kind of achieved a workable balance for dealing with IP infringement. And I think that we can come to sort of equally sensible compromises in censorship legislation as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair point. I mean, it'd be a whole separate show to discuss how decisions are made in government, as we're recording this show on Valentine's Day, February 14th. There's a continual concern that at least Congress will be unable to make decisions like whether to extend the payroll tax holiday, which from a political perspective seems like a no-brainer, but even that is subject to political machinations. So I think acknowledging an optimistic view of our decision-making process, I think, is an important one with this proposal, and I think it's one that ultimately is reflected in the proposal, but one that could become a political challenge once a proposal like this was actually put forward. But let's talk about that proposal in more detail. We've discussed it from a top level. What are the core elements, in your view, of a properly functioning censorship regime?
I think that the sort of key themes here are ones I've thought about previously in terms of international censorship. And they're really that I want any censorship regime to be open about what it's doing, to be transparent about the content that it targets, to be narrow so that it only focuses on sites that are judged unlawful, and one that is accountable, that not only is accountable through our standard democratic processes, but that also offers opportunities for challenge to sites that are censored. And I think that there are a lot of changes here from the way that censorship is occurring right now that would be beneficial, that would I think would be a net positive. So one is that I think we have to admit up front that what we want is, if we actually think that foreign sites, for example, are infringing intellectual property in a way that harms Americans, we shouldn't outsource that decision to IP rights holders, who will inevitably see harm in everything, right? So famously, Jack Valenti of the Motion Picture Association of America sees this new threatening technological device, the VCR, and says, the VCR is to the movie industry as the Boston Strangler is to a woman home alone. Mm-hmm. And IP rights holders have made massive errors in these calculations ever since, right? They were frightened of the player piece. They were frightened of the MP3 player. They went to court to try to block that. They were frightened of peer-to-peer file sharing networks, none of which have proved as disastrous as they thought. So I think what we need is that we need any censorship to take place only if you can convince somebody like an attorney general or an assistant U.S. attorney that the threat is sufficiently serious that we ought to devote public resources to it. So the first one is limited standing. We don't allow rights holders to censor. And this, I think, was one of the things that frightened people most about the Stop Online Piracy Act, is that it would have let rights holders, without any particular checks or balance, go to court and be able to cut off funding for these sites without any proof. The second thing is that I think that we need to reverse the burden of proof. Right now, the government gets to censor first and justify it later. That is exactly backwards. American constitutional tradition is exactly the opposite, which is you must justify restraining speech before you can do so. And so I think that the government ought to have to prove that the site or content that it's targeting is unlawful before they can censor it. And then I would say that there are really sort of two other key elements to my proposal. One is that right now, if you have a set of unlawful MP3 files on a site, the government can take down the whole site. So we saw this with the hip-hop blog Dajazz One, where rights holders alleged, hey, there are unlawful remixes on this site, and the government took the whole thing down. Turns out that they were wrong. They're ultimately unable to prove that the site was unlawful. In fact, it looked like a lot of that material was there with the authorization of the record labels who were using it as advanced marketing. But under my regime, what I would want is that the government can get a court order to go after the content that is infringing and not after the site. And this would much more closely mirror what we do today with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You don't get to take down the entire website. You get to take down the link or the file that is infringing. And that's much more narrow, right? So that leaves speech that's judged to be unlawful as censored. and liberal speech is untouched. And then the left that I'm worried about is essentially burdens. So one of the things that is smart about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and some of our other legislation is that it maintains the burden of enforcing IP rights on the entity that's sort of best positioned to engage in cost-benefit analysis for doing so, which is the rights holder. So if you want to go after a site, you have to sue them in court. Protect IP and SOPA propose to reverse that, which is all of a sudden intermediaries like Google or PayPal or ISPs would have to bear all of the costs of enforcing IP rights. And I want that to be flipped. If we are going to impose costs on intermediaries to enforce what we think of as a public good, IP enforcement, for example, we ought to pay to do so. And so I think we should publicly fund whatever additional infrastructure or personnel or other expenses that ISPs have to undertake as a way of engaging in censorship. And this kind of usefully provides a check. One of the best ways to keep the government from overusing an enforcement resource is to actually make them pay for it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, and we have about 5 or 6 minutes left at this point in the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you may not be able to answer in the time we have left. But you brought up Apple. You mentioned Apple in the article. You know, we've talked about governments, but you have private actors that also act in tandem with government or act in ways that seem censorious, although they may not be covered by your proposal. And so I'm curious, you know, where Apple as a censor fits into your definitions and into the equations, right? So, for example, Apple's ability to approve or disapprove a given application on its device as an example of censorship. How do you think about Apple as a censor?
So, indubitably, Apple is engaged in censorship. Google engages in a little bit of it quite explicitly in some countries. Most intermediaries do. Even spam filtering is a form of censorship. I worry a lot less about Apple, and I think in some ways this is a bit unusual because the people that we talk to worry a lot about Facebook and Google and Apple and other censors. And my reason for this is that if Apple wants to back up its censorship, the most it can do is keep you out of the App Store and find that you're in breach of the contract. If the American government wants to censor something, they will show up at your server room with a gun. And that's considerably more profound in terms of power. And one of the reasons that I worry less about Apple is that the history of information technology and of IT intermediaries is one of constant disruption. So 10 or 12 years ago, we were all extremely concerned about the Microsoft Windows 95 start page. That was where we thought censorship was going to occur. If you couldn't get your service on there, you were going to simply disappear. Today, I think the fear is about Google's power, or maybe Facebook's power, or Apple's power. And I think that as long as one has sort of meaningful market choice, and we could talk about how meaningful that is, somebody like Tim Wu would probably disagree with me here, users can vote for peace with their feet, to quote Lenin. They can move to less filtered platforms. So Google exercises a much lighter touch over the Android market, or you can look to BlackBerry or others. You can look to tablets that run Linux, for example. And so I think that private censorship is still a worry, particularly where it's invisible, but that it is far less of a concern than public censorship, which is where the government targets material. And even that may be less worrisome than public-private censorship, which is what I talk about with persuasion. When you take the discretion and lack of transparency that private entities have and the power of the federal government and combine those two, you potentially have a very worrisome situation.
Yeah, you know, I focus a bit, and I will be writing a bit about fusion centers, these entities of public-private data mining entities that are designed by state or local governments as law enforcement entities to go after terrorism. A couple of years ago, at this point, I had Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall and Daniel Citron from Maryland on discussing their concern about fusion centers. I'll ask you the same question. So, Apple less concern, fusion centers, is that a greater concern for you? They and to be clear, a fusion center can, although whatever limited data we have suggests that they're not doing as much as people fear, use private information shared by private entities and public information that is information either is public or is held by the government, and combine that to identify targets. Targets that could be shut down, as in a website, or targets that could be arrested, as in a terrorist. So I'm curious, again, same kind of general question. Fusion centers, from your perspective, focusing on censorship, bigger concern, less concern? Because there, for example, you do have DOJ guidelines that are designed to at least give you a sense of what fusion centers are actually up to.
The DOJ guidelines are helpful, and in fact, one of the most potent forms of control over things like surveillance is actually the Department of Justice's own internal guidelines and culture in terms of when you ask for a warrant and when you don't, and they're fairly rigorous about it. I think it provides at least as much protection as something like the ECPA, the statute, does. The fusion centers are a great example of precisely my worry, and Robert O'Hara writes about this in his book, No Place to Hide, where, especially after 9/11, you have all of these large private firms that are aggregating data about our credit record and our purchases, and maybe even the websites that we go to, essentially just offered up to the government. And there are very few controls on their doing so. So all of our controls are oriented towards the threat of government power. It sort of flows from the founding of the republic. We're not really oriented towards risk for private entities. We think that private bargaining contracts and user agreements can handle that. But it's particularly pernicious when we have a system that is oriented towards us making a deal with private firms that's then used by government. It lets government evade those constraints. And so fusion centers, I think, are a very good example to worry. And fusion centers often get it wrong, sort of like the censorship. So we saw the report that was put out by a fusion center that a water pump in a small town in Illinois had been hacked. It was like the first cyber attack against infrastructure. Everybody panics. And it turns out it was incorrect. It was actually some contractor who was working in Russia who rebooted the water pump. And everybody panicked. And the difficulty here is that the fusion centers are oriented towards dispersing information. They have no particularly good guidelines or set of internal controls right now for quality. And so I see exactly the same fear in the censorship zone, which is when you are allowing private entities to make some of these determinations and then the government simply enforces them, inevitably you get mistakes and inevitably you get overbroad censorship.
Mm-hmm. Derek, we're at a point where I have to make a tough call. The tough call is, do I ask one more question or do I ask a sum-up question? And unfortunately, I'm going to have to go with the sum-up question given our time. I do want to ask you, because you're always working on interesting things, this article is forthcoming in University of Chicago Law Review. What are you working on right now?
I'm working on two different things. I have sort of a two-track mind at best. One is to think about cybersecurity, and that's really in the zone of the fusion centers that you talked about. Cybersecurity is something, it's kind of like the weather. Everybody talks about it. Nobody does anything about it. And so I'm trying to reorient our thinking to a more sort of information-oriented approach to cybersecurity. And the second is I want to write a little bit about the myth of perfection in terms of censorship. So we think about censorship has to be perfect or the risk that it'll be perfect. And I think that that's the wrong way to go, similar to cybersecurity, is that censorship is enormously powerful and effective, even when it's not 100% foolproof. It's simply that if you affect the average user's average internet experience, you've already done a lot from a government's perspective.
Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, author of the forthcoming article, Orwell's Armchair, which when I post this show on Hearsay Culture, I will have a link to. And in fact, there is a link to it now on hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining us today on the show. I greatly enjoyed the discussion. I look forward to having you back down the road. But thanks for writing another terrific piece and enlightening my listeners.
Dave, thanks so much, and thanks so much to all your listeners for tuning into this.
My pleasure. I'm happy to mention several guests coming up for the remainder of this quarter on KZSU's schedule. Next week, March 2nd, Professor Daniel Margoxi of Hunter College, co-editor of States of Secrecy, a forthcoming volume of the British Journal of the History of Science. March 9th, Professor Jennifer Holt of the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of the book Empires of Entertainment, a look at the history of the U.S. media world from 1980 to the advent of the commercial internet in the mid-90s. Professor Julie Cohen of Georgetown Law, author of the book Configuring the Network Self. And rounding out this quarter, Professor Hamilton Bean of the University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. I also have a number of guests that I'm planning on interviewing in, down the road, probably in what will be the spring quarter of on KZSU's schedule. Among them, Baron Zocca of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book Next Digital Decade, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law regarding her article Illuminating Innovation, Jeremy Zimmerman of La Quadrature du Net, a public interest advocacy group in France focusing on a lot of the same issues that EFF does here in the United States, and others. And I emphasize the word others. I have had an exceptionally busy year, both with my own writing and the fact that I'm up for tenure and the fact that I've got a lot of students, which is all good busy, but it means that I do have more openings than I normally would at this point for the spring. I have a list of people I'd like to invite, but I want to solicit your input and suggestions. If you think there are good guests to have on the show, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com, as well as any other feedback you might have on the show. With regard to listening to the show, the best way to listen is live on KZSU Fridays at noon Pacific time, and you can stream the show if you're not in the traditional listening area of KZSU by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can pick up the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 155 plus previous shows, as well as a list of upcoming guests. You can also get the show by going to Stanford's iTunes page at the Center for Internet Society, where you can get not only Hearsay Culture but other events occurring at Stanford's Center for Internet Society. And lastly, you can go to the webpage for Stanford Law School Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening to today's show. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.